1 Corinthians 7:25-7:40, the 21st talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on August 11, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good morning. We are going to continue in 1 Corinthians this morning. Actually, we're going to finish chapter 7 and perhaps finish 1 Corinthians for a while. In chapter 7, this is this notorious chapter that seems to have Paul sort of damning marriage with faint praise. I guess you still could be a Christian and get married, although it's dubious. That's what it sounds like he's saying. Well, that's the way a lot of people have taken what he's saying. I've been trying to argue that that's not quite what's happening in chapter 7. In fact, what we need to remember is that Paul is speaking to a specific set of questions that he has been asked by the Corinthians that seem to arise from some of the Corinthians who have decided that sexuality is a less holy thing, that somehow to follow God and be holy, you should abstain altogether. And so Paul has been addressing various situations. Married people where one of the partners has decided that abstinence is more holy, and widowed, and people who are married and deciding to get divorced, I think, out of that sense that marriage is somehow a second best option and that they ought to just get out of it. And so in these various situations, what Paul has been doing is saying, no, your thinking about that is wrong. There is nothing second best about sexuality. Sexuality is intended for marriage, and that's an appropriate thing. Paul himself does see that there is a certain advantage to the single life, and today we're actually going to see the one place where he explains why he thinks that. The section we're starting with, we're basically starting from, let me see, where is it? Verse 25 through to the end of the chapter. Basically, we have three parts to this. There's the part where Paul specifically addresses the question that he has been asked, which has to do with virgins. And we'll have to talk about what he's getting at there. And then in the middle of that, he has two side comments explaining his thinking. And really, for us, probably the more interesting part of this is the two side comments that he makes. So I'm going to start out first by telling you what I think is the issue here, what he has to say about the specific question that he's asked, and then we'll talk about that part in the middle where he has these very meaningful and significant tangential comments to make. Okay, so now I just have to tell you right off as we go into this, I've been saying all along that chapter 7 is a difficult chapter and there are many decisions to make. This section here, starting in verse 25, is the most difficult part of the whole chapter. This is a famous area of debate as to what exactly the issue is in this section. And if you ever look at various translations, you may find that debate reflected in the way that you see it translated, because translators go in different directions as to how they understand what the issue is in this section. Part of the reason it is so debated is that there is no one option that does not have certain problems with it. Whichever way you go, you have to swallow something. Like if you take this option, okay, that works fine, but it does involve this particular Greek word over here being used in a way that seems to be somewhat unusual. Or if you take this option over here, okay, now that word is being used in its normal sense, but now that creates the problem over here, so what's happening with this? It's one of those situations where you can spend a lot of time sort of chasing the trails around trying to figure out what exactly is going on here. I can testify to this because that's what I've been doing. And what I'm here to do is to report to you the state of my thinking about this passage as it stands right now. But it is tough. Okay, There are two decisions that I have made that have determined my approach to this section. I want to tell you what those are so that you have some idea of why I'm going in the direction that I'm going here. First of all, in verse 26, many translations read something like, "In view of the present distress, it is good for a man to remain as he is." And a lot of commentators would put a great deal of emphasis on that, "in view of the present distress." Ah, this is the situation that has led to what Paul says here. Many say that he's talking about terrible persecution, this was a time when Christians were facing persecution, and so his argument is it would be better not to be married right now because things are so tough. And many people go in that direction and understand him to be saying that. Others would say, well, it's not that there's any particular difficulty that they're facing, it's just that life is filled with tribulations. And because life is filled with tribulations, you would be better off not to be married. Well, I don't think either of those is, in fact, what he's getting at there. And here is my thinking. This Greek word that they have translated as distress in this passage is used twice in this section. A little later on, in verse 37, Paul talks about a man who is under no constraint, or a man who is not under necessity, something like that. That's the same word, that word that they've translated constraint or necessity. That's the same word that we have here, because that word can be translated necessity, pressure, constraint. So I asked myself the question, which seems to be a question that not many commentators have asked themselves here. I'm not quite sure why that is. But I asked myself the question, well, what would happen if we assumed that Paul's using the word in the same sense in both places, that he actually has this idea in mind, and he's used this word twice with the sense of necessity, constraint, something that is pushing and compelling me. And so in that case then, the issue would not be in view of the present distress or tribulation, but rather the question is whether a man in making this decision that he faces is under some necessity, if there is some constraint, some obligation that he is under that would determine which way he chooses. That's what I think is happening, and I'll explain that in a minute, what it is that I'm doing. But part of what I want you to understand is the reason I'm going this way is it seemed to me that it might be a fruitful line to take to see Paul as actually using this word in the same sense in the context. Okay, my second decision involves the question of what is the issue? What is the question that has been asked here, and what is Paul saying to them? We always have to ask this question, especially in a letter like 1 Corinthians. They have written him with questions, and he is responding to them. And unfortunately for us, we don't have their letter where they asked the questions, so we're having to kind of read backwards and figure out what is the question that Paul is answering here. Some see the issue here, the question being, should those who have never married marry? Should virgins marry? We talk about married people up above, and now the question is, should those who have never married marry? And the typical answer that people give is, well, he starts out with his general statement, no, they should. I think it would be better if they didn't. And then, after his little interlude, when he gets down to verse 37, 36, wherever it is there, he takes on a different question, should a father give his daughter in marriage? So the question is, should virgins get married? And his initial response is, I think it would be better if they didn't. And then with the specific issue of should the father give his daughter in marriage, the answer is, well, I think it would be better if he didn't as well. With the proviso in all of this that he's saying it's okay if you do. Okay. The problem is that line of thinking is tied to this very famous interpretive problem in the passage. In that last part of the section, is Paul talking about a father and his daughter, or is he talking about a young man and his fiancée? That's the issue that gets debated. In your translation, if you look at the New American Standard, you'll notice down further on that the word daughter is in there, perhaps in brackets or in italics or something like that. They're indicating that that's not in the text, and that's right. It's not in the text. But it's a decision that they have made. That must be the issue. The issue is a father giving his daughter in marriage. But there is another way to take it, which is to see the issue as being a man and his virgin, that is, the young girl to whom he is engaged. I think at this point, although I recognize there are many problems on all sides of this, so I'm willing to be dissuaded from this perspective, but right now, what makes pretty good sense to me is that the issue in this section is indeed a man engaged. And the question that Paul has been asked right from the beginning is, okay, Paul, we have this idea, as was expressed at the top of the chapter, it is better for a man not to touch a woman. And so we have these various, we're sure you agree with us about that, Paul, we know you have similar ideas, and so we have these questions about these various situations, what we should do. And one of the situations is, what does a man do who is engaged to someone? Given the fact that we think that it is better for a man not to touch a woman, this is kind of a problem. What should he do in that situation? And I understand that to be the question from the beginning. That is, when he says, now concerning virgins, he is saying, now concerning the question you asked me about what a man ought to do in relationship to a young maiden to whom he is engaged. That is the question that has been asked. As I understand it. Okay. That being the case then, I'm going to read you just the parts that deal with the question. I'm going to leave out his parenthetical comments in the middle because we're going to talk about those in a minute. But let me read you my translation here of this section. This is not a great translation, but at least it'll show you kind of how I think this is heading. Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think therefore that this is good. Considering his present necessity, it is good for a man to be as he is. Are you bound to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a woman? Do not seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned, and if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Yet such will have tribulation in the flesh, and I am trying to spare you. And then he comes back to this in verse 36. But if any man thinks that he is acting improperly toward his virgin, if she should be of full age, and if it ought to be this way, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let them marry. But he who stands firm in his heart, being under no necessity, but he has authority over his own will, and has decided this in his own heart to keep his own virgin, he will do well. So then, both he who marries his virgin does well, and he who does not marry will do better. That's what I understand, something like what the translation of this should be. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. There are so many different little questions, and I just don't think there's any profit in going into them. If you would like to ask me in the question and answer time any questions you have about, well, what about this word here, and why are you saying that, that's fine. I just want to kind of give you the overall picture as I see it. Paul is not saying at that beginning part, is anyone bound to a wife, then do not seek to be released. He is not saying if you're married, don't try to get divorced. I think that's the key to understanding this whole section. What he's saying is, are you bound to a woman? That is, are you in such a situation where you are engaged and obligated to marry? Then stay as you are. Don't seek to be released. But if you are released, then do not seek a wife. That's his advice as I understand it. He does not say what he thinks this necessity is in this situation. What would be the necessity. I think that it's something like this. If I'm putting this together right, what he's saying is, if a young man is engaged and wants to marry, and his fiancée is of age and wants to marry him, then he should not listen to this idea of the Corinthians that it is better for a man not to touch a woman. He has made a real commitment to her and has a real desire, and it is appropriate for them to follow through on that. So, actually, this section is not a statement that if you're not married, don't get married. He's actually saying, if I'm following what he's saying right, is if you are in an engagement and it is a real engagement with a commitment and desire on the part of the people, then go ahead. There's nothing wrong with that. But, he's saying, if the man is under no necessity but has authority over his own will, and I think what he's getting at is it's a situation where he has discretion. I don't know exactly what that would be. Maybe the situation is the girl is not of age yet, and it was an arranged situation where there is not a great deal of commitment on either side. I don't know. I don't know enough about the situation to be able to say. But if he is not under necessity and has authority over his own will, that is, he can do what he wants, he is in a situation where there is not a compulsion, but he can choose to do what he wants, rightly and honorably, and he has decided that he does not want to marry, that he thinks that it would be better to remain single, then that's a fine thing to do. That's how I understand the situation. Now, like I say, ask me questions afterwards. I'm sure you'd be able to tear it all to pieces. The problem is anything I had said, you would be able to tear to pieces because this is a difficult passage. But that's how I understand the situation. Basically what he's saying is, my advice to those who are engaged and considering whether they should marry in this situation is, if there is a situation where you feel that it is desirable and necessary for you to marry, then do it. And if you choose not to and you have the freedom not to, then fine, that would be great. Okay. From my perspective, the particular issue that he's exploring here is not as interesting to us right now as is that middle section, the comments that he makes in the middle, because he has two very interesting things to say. One of them doesn't really have to do with marriage at all, but just speaks to every one of us as believers. And the other one is the one place where he actually gives something of his rationale why he likes being single. And we want to talk about both of those things. Okay, so, first of all then, in verse 29, he has just made this statement that, given his judgment on what it is he thinks ought to happen with this situation where they're asking the question, should we seek to be released in the situation or not? He's given his judgment, and then he says, but this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for the form of this world is passing away. I think what Paul is saying here is a very important passage for all of us. This is a fundamental truth. He's stepping back and saying, I want you to look at this issue of whether you marry or not in the light of something very much bigger. Now, for some strange reason, I don't know why, but it's because of this certain idea that commentators have gotten about what Paul must be arguing in this section, that when they get to this section, they seem to disregard what he actually says. Because they see that language, the time has been shortened, and what he goes on to say about being undistracted in service to the Lord. And they decide the issue is here that Paul sees that there's only a short time to serve the Lord. Maybe Jesus is going to come back soon and you've only got a little bit of time to serve God, so don't waste it by being married. Which is crazy, because that's not at all what he's saying in this section. That's not the argument in any way. He's not saying don't get married because you don't want to waste your time with that stuff. He's saying, look, the form of this world is passing away. It's not just marriage. Look at what he says. Those who have wives should be as though they had none. Even if you are married, there's a sense in which it's as if you're not. Those who weep as if they did not weep. Even if you are sad, there is a sense in which you are not, which is a strange thing to say. Those who rejoice, there's a sense in which you're not rejoicing. Those who buy, there's a sense in which it's as if you don't really own that which you have bought. Those who use the world as if they don't make full use of it. Why? The form of this world is passing away. Now that Christ has come, we are in the last days, they're called. The last days are not just those few days before Jesus comes back and, you know, the Antichrist and all of that sort of stuff. The Bible talks about the last days as being this era in which we live from the time of Christ. Because something fundamental changed there. What we see of God in the scriptures in the Old Testament and how he dealt with people, God often tied his lessons to material things. He shows his faithfulness by giving long life, by giving peace and abundance in the land of Israel, by giving prosperity to a family, and so on. And he does appeal to those things at times, as look at his faithfulness in these situations. Look at how in this life I have prospered in some way. But the coming of Christ has made it abundantly clear that those were only pictures. The fact is that the blessing of God is not to be found ultimately in whatever good things come my way in this life. Not that they're not good things, and not that they are inappropriate to enjoy. God talks about being grateful for the things that he has given us. Paul talks about marriage as something to be enjoyed with gratitude, and he speaks against those who forbid marriage. So it's not that there's anything wrong with those things, but ultimately there is something bigger going on. The fact is that this is not the main act. The fact is that this stuff, all of which that seems so important and so significant to me, is really just the overture. I mean, the curtain hasn't even really gone up on the first act in a certain sense. I mean, there is something better coming. Something that is really intended to be the completion, the fulfillment of what God is doing now. And so, living in a world where people think this is it, you know, you only go around once, so you have to grab for all the gusto you can and whatever else beer commercials may have told us. The fact is that that's not the truth. The fact is that this is the place, this is the arena in which I am making the choices that are going to determine where I spend eternity. Either I have set my heart and my focus on the promise of God and the salvation that he is bringing, the rescue from sin and death and futility and suffering and all of it that he is bringing about, or else I have set my heart on this world. And I think what Paul is saying is that now the time has been shortened, not in the sense that he knows that Jesus is coming back next month so that we don't have much time, but that however long it takes Jesus to come back, the fact is that we are living with this sense that the form of this world is passing away. What was hinted at in the Old Testament has been made abundantly clear to us, that the point of this is something other than what we're involved with now. This is important. This is significant. But its significance lies in the opportunity it presents us to choose to follow God. Not that it is so important now whether I am married or am not married. It is not even so significant now whether I am rejoicing or whether I am weeping. Because in the end, there is a joy to come that is going to overwhelm both of those things. The question is, do you see where you're headed? Do you know that the form of this world is passing away? The time has been shortened. This is not the point. It seems to me that this is a very important thing that Paul is saying. It's much broader in its application than just the question of whether people are going to get married or not. What he's really saying is, in the end, it doesn't matter so much what you decide here. Certainly it matters. It's going to have an impact on your life in a significant way. It's not that God says, oh, that's nothing. He's not saying it's nothing. But in the scale of things, it's not as significant a question. It's not as significant an issue as the issue of what happens when the form of this world passes away and you face eternity, either fulfilled with God or cast aside. That's the significant question. So I think what he wants to say to them is, look, I do think that there is an advantage to not getting married. There are certain troubles in the flesh that you're going to take on if you get married, and I recognize an advantage to not taking those on. But in the end, that's not really the issue. Take them on or don't take them on. The fact is, you need to live, if you're married, as if you're not. And let's all be really clear what we mean by that. The fact, he doesn't mean that I don't have the obligations that a married person has. I do have those obligations. But what he's saying is, in terms of my ultimate commitments, in terms of what really matters to me, in the end, the question of whether I'm married or not is of secondary importance. The form of this world is passing away. This is a very hard lesson for us to learn, but it is a profound one, I think. Paul's expectation, his exhortation to them in this situation is something like, marry or don't marry, it's okay, but don't lose sight of what this is about. Don't lose sight of the purpose of your life. And that's something that we need to take to heart, whatever our situation is. Okay. Now, he then goes on to make the clearest statement he makes about why he thinks there is some advantage to being single. Now, I've been arguing all along that Paul is not commanding singleness. He is not even saying that it is second best. It is a gift from God. He made that clear at the beginning. Each person has their own gift from God. Singleness is a gift, and marriage is a gift. Each of them is a gift. I should see them as something that God has given that has its benefits, and it has its challenges as well. But Paul, who is single at this point, has a particular issue in mind that he wants them to think about as they're thinking about this question of whether they're going to marry. And that starts in verse 32. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and he has been divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own benefit, not to put a noose upon you, but to promote that which is proper and to promote undistracted devotion to the Lord. Now, on the one hand, we want to recognize that Paul does have something to say for the value of the state of being single. But this section here has been, I think, misunderstood often and distorted in his intent. He is not saying that it is wrong to be concerned with pleasing your wife. We get this idea that the single person can be single-mindedly devoted to God. Everything he does is with God in mind. Whereas the married person, sometimes he's thinking about how he can please his wife. He doesn't care about what God wants. He's going to do what his wife wants. His wife is distracting him away from the path of holiness. And so these terrible women come along, and here I am trying to be a holy man, and I made the mistake of getting married, and she's sucking me into worldliness and degradation. And I mean, and let's be fair, he says the same thing is true on the other side. The man is just as much a distraction. So how can you even hardly even be a Christian and be married? Because God wants you to do this, but your wife's saying, no, I want you to do this. And you're divided. You're, instead of having a pure heart, your allegiances are divided. And sometimes you don't side with God, you side with your wife. And that's a terrible place to be. That's not what he is saying, I would argue. The kind of division that he's talking about here is something different. And here's how I would describe it. He basically is making one point. This is his statement about why he sees a certain advantage to being single. This is the only advantage, as I understand it. This is the one argument he makes. Every Christian, whether they are married or whether they are single, cannot just please themselves. We cannot just say, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. Every Christian has an obligation to seek to be pleasing to God. If there is a choice between what I want to do and what God wants me to do, I have an obligation to consider what God wants me to do and do that instead. So I have to ask myself, what is pleasing to God in my life? I can't just be free of any consideration of what anybody else thinks. I have to at least think about what God wants for my life. But because marriage is rightly, appropriately designed by God to be two people bringing their lives together, a married person has another limitation on his or her freedom. Not only must I consider what God wants, but I have to consider what my spouse wants as well. I am not on my own. Rightly and appropriately, it's not that God is saying, go to the mission field, and my wife is saying, no, stay here and fix the roof. It's that the single person has basically one obligation that they have taken on, the obligation to God. The married person has two obligations that they have taken on, an obligation to God and an obligation to their spouse. That's not a wrong thing. That's not a bad thing. It's not an evil thing. It's the way God made things. The two shall become one flesh. That's what marriage is all about. But it does mean, in fact, that as I consider the range of my options and how I am going to proceed, I have to consider the desires of my spouse. I am not free to just do what I want. I am a married person, and we have to work this out together. So that means, then, that there are certain obligations that I am taking on in marriage, a certain restriction of what I can choose to do that I am taking on when I enter into the married life. So Paul is not pitting the desire to please God against the desire to please the spouse. If I am married, God wants me to consider the desires of my spouse. Not that I do everything that they want. I mean, it's something we have to work out together. But the fact is, it is godly, it is appropriate, it is obedient for me to consider the desires of my spouse in this situation, because this is an obligation that I have taken on. So as I understand what he's arguing here, what I do want, as he concludes, I want to promote what is proper, and I want to promote undistracted devotion to the Lord. I do want you to understand, if you're going to enter into marriage, that you do have an obligation to both of those parties, and I want you to make sure that you realize that you continue to have the obligation to God, even as you have that obligation to your spouse. He's not saying, I'm trying to promote undistracted devotion to the Lord, so I don't want people to get married. He's not saying that only unmarried people can have undistracted devotion to the Lord. I think that's the place where we get confused. Because I am devoted to the Lord when I am serving my family. When I am fulfilling my obligation to my family, I am pleasing God, because that's what He has called me to do. I'm not being distracted from God. I am, if I am living as a godly husband, a godly spouse, husband or wife, I am serving God's interests. I am doing what God wants me to do. I am being obedient. So He's not saying that marriage is necessarily a distraction from serving God. But it does divide you in the sense that the choices that you could have made as you seek to be a person pleasing God, the nature of the life that you're living has changed. You have a set of obligations now that put a certain limit on what you can choose to do. And I think Paul would say, for himself, for instance, as an apostle, that I would not have the freedom to do everything that I do if I were married, because I would have an obligation that I would have to keep there. So, in the end, I think what Paul wants them to think about is, on the one hand, what the Corinthians, some of them have been saying about it is good for a man not to touch a woman, their thinking there, their ascetic thinking, that somehow it is better to abstain, it is more holy to abstain, he's saying that's not true at all. There is no sin in marriage, and it is a good gift from God. And he will make that clear in other passages too, that marriage is a good thing. But you Corinthians have recognized that I, Paul, do have a certain attraction to the single life. And here's the reason why I have that attraction. Is I do recognize that in getting married, you are taking on an obligation that limits what you can choose to do. And I am grateful for, in my situation, the fact that I have the freedom to devote myself to being an apostle without having to consider my wife's situation. I think that's what he is getting at. But he says, I don't want to put a noose on you. I'm not trying to catch you and say, you know, no, you've got to do it this way. Marriage is a fine thing. Marriage is a good thing. And it is, in fact, as other parts of the Bible make it clear, including Paul, it is what we have been designed for. He's not knocking it, but he is suggesting that in the light of the fact that our lives are ultimately about God and His kingdom, it is certainly an appropriate and desirable thing, if you're the right sort of person in the right sort of circumstances, to have a life where you have the freedom to do in your service to God that which you want to do, without having to consider the needs of the other person that you have made this commitment to. Okay, so, does Paul have an attraction for the single wife? Is he saying, I would recommend it, there's an advantage to it? I think that's clearly true. But is he anti-marriage? No. Is he saying marriage is second best? No. The good that marriage is a different sort of good. I mean, I can just say for myself that you could say in theory, for me, if I had not married, I would have much more freedom to serve God and be involved in ministry and stuff. And you might think, gee, if Ron wasn't married, we could get a lot more out of him around here than we do. But the fact is, looking at my own life, if I had not married, I would have very little worth saying to you at this point. Because my marriage has been one of those places where I have done some of the most learning about myself and what it means to be a sinner following God. So, I mean, it hasn't been second best. It has been an incredible gift and an incredible arena in which to learn. So, I don't think Paul is suggesting anything opposite to that. He is speaking to people who have decided that asceticism is good, that it's good to stay away from marriage. And what he wants to say is, okay, well, let me qualify this for you. Yeah, there is a sense. If you want to argue that that there's something good about staying away from marriage, I could agree with you. There is something good, but not the good that you guys think. Not this sense that there's something wrong with it or that the holy life somehow involves abstinence. That's all wrong. That's not what it's about. What it's about is being faithful in the arena in which I find myself, whether in marriage or in singleness. Okay, so that's it. That's what I think is going on in chapter 7. I think I'll stop there. This has been a long week for us. I think I have run out of words. I don't have any more left. So you can ask questions and I will find my answers for you.
I've got two or three questions about Paul himself. He was a Pharisee. Now, they didn't have to be celibate like a Catholic priest, did they?
No. No, in fact, they were encouraged to marry, which is why many people have argued that many would argue that he must have been married earlier and not be married now. He seems to be single now, but that it would just, the argument would be, it would be unthinkable that a Pharisee would not marry.
Or could it have been because he hadn't gotten married before his conversion?
Yeah,
he was 18 or 22 or, you know.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, that's possible as well. I don't have any strong conviction about that myself, but no, it's definitely not the case that as a Pharisee they were called to celibacy, very far from it.
Okay.
Do you have an opinion about that, Jack? Do you think Paul was married before?
I can't remember the evidence that they give, but the theory is that when he became a Christian, his wife left him. And, you know, that he says it elsewhere that if an unbelieving, if your unbelieving woman wants to leave you, let her leave. She's not under obligation. You're not under obligation. It takes two to make a marriage. And if the actual issues of the faith itself split you apart, then there's nothing you can do about it. And some people argue that that's what happened to him. But we just don't have, clear, unambiguous evidence, so it's hard to say.
Being a single person, I've thought a lot about this stuff, and one of the things I recognize in myself is being single is not necessarily, there's nothing inherently about the single state that encourages you to use your additional freedom for God. That it's, there have been some times that I've envied people in a married state because there's a whole lot less opportunity for somebody to pull me up by the scruff of the neck and say, "Hey, you selfish idiot," you know. And it seems to me in our culture that's much more the case too. There's so many more people who are single now than I think of probably the larger percentage that have ever been in the history of the world. And it's because, largely because they covet that freedom, but they don't covet the freedom to serve God. And even in the Christian church, I think I have actually heard people talking about their singleness as being somehow a preferable state, that you know, just like Paul, they're single. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they're in pseudo marriages where they get a lot of the goodies of marriage without the obligation. And I was just wondering if you could talk about the right way and the wrong way to be single, perhaps.
Right. Well, I'm no expert on the single life because I wasn't any good at it when I was single. let me make the comment. What I think is helpful is for us to remember in this section, all of this is aimed at the question. These are people who are trying to argue for what is the holy life? What should we do to follow God and please God? Okay, it's all, he's not just talking about the woman. You think that, Paul, don't you? And so we've decided, you know, we've got people who are getting divorced because they think marriage is second best. And we have people who are married who are deciding they're not going to have sexual relations anymore because, or one of them has decided that they're not going to have sexual relations anymore because that's second best. And all of these things. And we have people who are engaged who are thinking, well, I'm engaged and I'd really like to get married, but it's better for a man not to touch a woman, so I guess to be faithful to God I should get out of this, or, you know, that sort of thing. And so Paul's coming around and saying, oh, all right, if you want to talk about it from the angle of your desire is to serve God, then fine. If you have obligations, you need to keep those obligations. If your desire is to serve God and you recognize with me that you might have more freedom to do certain things if you were not married, then join me in not being married. But the issue is not that in and of itself singleness or marriage provides a better environment for all kinds of things. The issue is if you have this idea in your head that you want to serve God through some act of sacrifice or something, well, let me correct you in thinking that somehow the sacrifice of your sexuality is somehow what holiness requires. And the only one that makes sense to me is if that you think, I have something to do for God that is going to be harder to do if I get married, and I would like not to be married to do that. That's a fine thing. Do that. Great. So, in that sense, all Paul is speaking to here, I think, is that sense of, if you're trying to sort out your call in that sense, he would support the idea that you might find certain freedom in not marrying that you wouldn't otherwise. But singleness in and of itself, I agree with what you're saying. Just as marriage, it is marriage or singleness, either way, is a place where if we're going to be self-centered people, that will come out. And I can... The idea that somehow the state itself is superior, and then I kind of live, as you say, in the best of both worlds, that's just foolish. That's not wisdom. That's worldliness. That's just saying, hey, I look around and I see that, you know, there's kind of some action here. I kind of like this single life. And Paul did too. No, not that way. Nothing like that was on his mind at all. So, you have to get yourself oriented right. If you're asking the right question, yeah, there's something, an advantage to singleness. But if you find yourself as a single person, that doesn't mean that Paul's saying, aha, that means that God has called you to, you know, you must live a life, you know, you have to go to the mission field, or you have to take one of those posts where the unmarried people can't go. He's not trying to put a noose on us. I don't think in any sense. It's just, look, here I am. I'm living my life. What does God want from me? Everyone faces that question. So if you're a single person, then you face the question, what does God want from me? And if you're a married person, you face the question, what does God want from me? And the question, what does my spouse want from me? And you have to answer both of them.
In verse 26, it says, I have no commandment of the Lord, but I give my judgment.
Yes.
And in verse 6, it says, I speak this by permission and not of commandment.
Uh-huh.
Is he saying, King's Act here, I'm no longer speaking by revelation? I'm just speaking the bias of a bachelor?
Yeah, I think it's going a little... It's stronger than that. When he makes a distinction, earlier on, he made this distinction. He says, not I, but the Lord. And what he's referring to is that Jesus has specifically spoken to the issue of divorce. And so he's quotes that. Then he says, not the Lord, but I say. And there he's talking about the fact that Jesus had not spoken directly to the issue of a believer and an unbeliever being married. We don't have any words of Jesus saying something about that. Okay, so there I think what he's getting at is I can't point you to Jesus having said anything about this because he didn't. And I think the same thing is true here. He's saying I have no Jesus didn't say anything. Nothing has been told me that says there is, God has a command regarding the situation. But that doesn't in and of itself determine for us how strongly to take what Paul says. Because when he says that if the unbelieving spouse is willing to stay with you, don't send them away, I don't think he's saying that's just my opinion, but you're free to disregard it. There, he's saying, I mean, the judgment that he's giving is one that is based on the nature of marriage. Even though you're married to an unbeliever, you don't have the freedom to leave yourself just because they're an unbeliever, if they're willing to still maintain a marriage with you. Here, the judgment that he's giving, the reason that we know that is less than a command is because he says so as he goes along. That what he's saying is, here is what I would recommend. But he makes it clear that it is a recommendation based on certain thinking that he has about what might be appropriate. But that there is freedom here. When he says, I'm not putting a noose on you, what he's saying is, I am not giving you a commandment. I am not telling you that this is the way it ought to be. I'm telling you that in my judgment, this would be a good thing to think about as you're doing this. But you're free to marry. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. So I think, yes, ultimately he is suggesting that this, I guess I would say it a little differently though than the way you did. Is the way you said it is the way I used to think of it. The way I'm thinking of it now is, he's saying, it is my firm and determined judgment that there is some advantage to staying single and you have the freedom to choose which way you go. If that makes sense. I mean, it's like, my preference would be this for this reason, and I think it's a good reason. At the end, I didn't talk about it, he repeats the thing about a woman staying married, but if she's widowed, he says, I think she's better off to stay as she is, and I think I have the Spirit of God. What he seems to be suggesting is, I think that the Spirit of God has given me understanding of things such that my judgment here is a good one. I think, indeed, that there is an advantage to her to stay the way she is. But if she wants to marry, it's okay. So, I guess my answer to your question is kind of yes and no. He's not disclaiming responsibility for it. He's not saying I could be wrong. I guess that's what I'm saying. He's not saying I could be wrong, because what he's saying is not don't marry. He's saying is there are advantages to not marrying. And he's not saying I might be wrong about that. He is right about that. That advantage is there. But in a particular circumstance, in a particular person's life, the gift that God is working in their life, the commitments they have, and so forth, it might work out very different. In spite of the fact that there's a certain advantage to this, it may be that the gift in their life is going to be this other thing. And that's fine, he's saying. That's great. Okay. Somebody's got the mic. Oh, Nancy.
It seems to me that on either side of the question, I like what you just ended with by saying, he's saying, I think this would be my preference, and there's certain wisdom in that, but you're free.
Yeah.
And you can do either one.
Yeah.
I think that we have a tendency to compare a lot with each other's states, mm-hmm. and to think that must be better. The state I'm in must be better,
mm-hmm.
or
the other way,
or worse,
yeah,
in some way.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that's a really human tendency. Mm-hmm. I wanted to speak a minute to the kind of applying this principle of taking the state that God has given us and running with it, basically, that this is the context I find myself, and therefore this is where I need to figure out what it means to serve God and to be responsible. And I think with on both sides of the coin, there are specific challenges and obligations. I guess I wanted to speak a minute to younger people who are single. I think in our culture we have a really conflicted view of how to get married. And it might not be totally on the subject of what you're talking about today, but it seems significant that we have this drive to be married. And I can imagine, I know that when I heard this teaching when I was quite a bit younger, I didn't want to think about the possibility of not marrying.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed just unthinkable. And here I am, and it hasn't been, you know, it's been up and down. But I guess what I wanted to say is that even in that state, I don't think we need to worry as much as we worry about how do I get there? How do I get to be married? That there's a certain sense of, there's a lot right and a lot good about working at being responsible, even as a very young person, to being single. I don't know if I'm really getting what I want to say here, except that I guess I want to say that being single, if we're not married, we ought to not act like we're married and kind of not be, that's not the culmination of everything we ought to strive for, that God gives this gift and he will give it whether we're working at it or not. But even no matter what the state, that all the yearnings and longings and things that are part of my humanness are going to be what I have to work with and what I have to face into. And so maybe one question we can ask ourselves is, how do I love the people around me, and how do I commit myself to being responsible with my yearnings? I spoke with a couple people this week who are younger and really concerned about trying to do that, and I guess that's part of what's behind my thoughts about it. It seems like we want so badly to be in a couple that we can easily not notice how we are communicating to one another, whether it's with flirting or kind of going somewhere, making a promise that we're not really making, and how we relate in a friendship. All those things, I think that's part of what Paul would say here and now. We need to really look at how we are responsible with our own needs and longings and concentrate on what it means to be wise rather than on what it means to get my needs met.
Right. Right.
And that's a very difficult thing to do, whether you're married or single.
Right, right. But that's a very wise thing, because what we're recognizing is that this now, today, where I am, whatever desires I may have, where I am right now is my opportunity to learn to be faithful. The fact is, to live my life responsibly is more important and even more valuable to me than getting my desires. If I get what I want and I lose the opportunity to be faithful in the process, I haven't gained. I've lost, and I will pay the price actually somewhere along the line. So the time to decide to pursue integrity and God's will is now, not someday after I get what I want.
In back in verse 26, when he talks about the impending distress, demand, whatever, could you go back and talk about what that is and how that would affect, in the light of that, how that would affect his advice, i.e. if there were no impending distress, would his advice be different?
Right, well, that's where I was saying I don't think it's distress. What he's saying, I think, is you're asking me the question whether someone who, what should be done in those situations where I think the men are asking this question. I'm engaged to a young girl, and here we are sorting out this, you know, it's better for a man not to touch a woman and so forth, so what should I do? And what he's saying is basically, I think what you need to do is think about what is your present necessity. That is, what is your situation? Are you in fact in an engagement where the right thing to do. You are under constraint. You have made a commitment, an obligation, and the appropriate thing to do is you are bound to this woman. Therefore, stay that way, I think is what he's saying. And likewise, if the situation is such that you really do feel that you have authority over your own will, and you are not under necessity, then, and you decide that you don't want to marry, then I think that would be a good thing to do. So that's what I understand him to be saying. It has nothing to do with distress or their current circumstances. What he's saying is, my advice is, look at the situation in the light of what in fact is your obligation and what do you want to do, and act accordingly. That's what I understand him to be saying.
So my liner note here that says literally intending on that word,
well,
present.
But that's debated. I think actually,
okay.
I think present is actually the correct way to translate it.
So in view of the present demands.
Yeah.
And how does that, I guess I'm still having a little, maybe I'm not hearing what, absorbing what you're saying.
Well, maybe I'm not making any sense.
In view of, okay, what about when not in view of, when we don't see that current demand, how would his advice change?
Okay, well, but you have to understand the question that he's asking. A person is in a situation where they have to assess that. That is, if I'm right, and I may be wrong in how I'm putting this together, but the issue is, what he's saying is you have the freedom to act based on how you assess. In a way, it's kind of saying, so how deep are you into this? And if you feel like you're in deep enough that you need to continue on, then do so. And if you're not, and you want not to, then fine. I think that's all he's saying. Assess your situation, this engagement that you're in. Do you think the right thing to do is for you to continue with it? Then don't jump out of it just because it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Don't do that. But on the other hand, if you have freedom here, and you have decided that it would be better for you not to marry, then go ahead and exercise that freedom. And that's from my perspective, I, Paul, I think that's a desirable thing. That's what I understand him to be saying. Jack, it looks like you had a comment on this. I've never talked to Jack about this, so now Jack's going to tell you what's really going on.
No, on the contrary, I think, unfortunately, I think you apologize too much. I mean, what you argue there is completely, completely cogent, and it actually indicates a difference in approach to the scriptures that we are trying to practice here, even compared to many translators. That their translators, all too often, we live in a Christian culture that has so atomized the Bible into verses and segments that we don't even look for it to be an intelligent, cogent, rational argument. And because they're not looking for that, they don't translate it accordingly, and they don't make their decisions accordingly. And I think that's what you have done, and rightly so. These are the conclusions I have reached about this passage as well. I think the thing to keep in mind is that it's a different culture. And there are social obligations, there are cultural obligations, there are legal and economic obligations that need to be met. And what Paul is saying is, as Ron says, if you assess your situation such that you have a social, cultural, legal, economic, and ultimately moral obligation to another person, then you don't have a choice. I mean, righteousness, morality, goodness, integrity demands that you keep your obligation, keep your word. And no amount of advantage of marriage, I mean, I'm sorry, advantage of the single life or devotion to the kingdom of God unfettered by obligations, none of that can overturn the fact that you have an obligation. You're stuck. You gave your word and you need to keep your word, which I think is just significant here that, however, even though he has this opinion that there's a tremendous advantage to the single life, it doesn't trump keeping your word for him, but that's far more significant. Hitchhiking on what Nancy was saying, we often teach at the Study Center on marriage, sexuality, love, romance, dating. We're going to do the most extensive series we've ever done this coming fall. So if anyone is interested in exploring all these topics in detail, we are going to take 20 weeks, the fall and the winter, Tuesday nights, devoted to love, sex, marriage, romance, and so on. So stay tuned. And can't remember the third thing I was going to say.
Let's have one last. Jesse had her hand up there.
I don't know if this is what Logan was asking, but talking about an impending situation or obligation that you have. Okay, so I'm single, completely free of any obligation, and I read this passage.
Mm-hmm.
So am I supposed to, now that I know that singleness is preferable, according to Paul, am I supposed to just keep that in my head, and if I meet somebody or develop a friendship, I just say, no, Paul says singleness is better, so I'm just not even going to go there with that person?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's true, he's speaking into that situation. How are you going to decide what to do in this engagement? And I agree with Jack. I don't have a real clear picture of it, but the social, cultural dynamic of what was going on with engagement was a lot different in their setting than it is for us. But we need to remember the things that he says in here about each person has their own gift from God, and in spite what he's saying in here, in spite of my advice, he's saying, if you want to marry, go ahead. So, and the advice is not, he's not saying if you marry, that must mean that you're not really interested in following God. Because you're going to have to follow God as a married person just as you're going to have to follow God as a single person. That doesn't change. It's just, if you, it's really, he's speaking to people who have this idea, you know, the Corinthians are saying, we want to be tops at this stuff. We want to really go at it. And he's saying, well, all right, if you should decide that you have something that you could do to serve God, and you want to stay single so that you can do that with your full attention without being involved in this other thing over here, I mean, without being involved in marriage, great. That I like that. That's where I am. But each person has his own gift from God. He's not denigrating marriage, and he's not saying that it's unwise to consider getting married. I mean, the fact is that marriage is still going to be, even in our culture, I mean, we're designed for marriage. And so, in that sense, it's entirely appropriate. If I feel a desire to be married, I don't have to say to God, God isn't saying to me, that shows that you're not dedicated to me. He made us the way we are, in that sense. So, to pursue a desire to be married, I think, is entirely in keeping with what he's talking about here. He's recognizing that that desire is not wrong. And if you have that desire, it's fine. He's talking to people who think that asceticism is good, and he's saying, well, no, asceticism isn't good, but choosing to be single for the sake of the freedom it gives you to pursue a certain ministry to God, that's a good thing. If you want to do that, I approve of that. That's where I am. I like that. That's good. I mean, there's... But my concern is, he's saying, I don't want to tell you what to do. I don't want to put a straitjacket on you and tell you which way it has to go. I just want to make sure, as you're thinking about this, that you realize that ultimately there are more important issues involved. That your eternal state with God is ultimately more important as to whether you get married or not. That way, then, in keeping with what Nancy was talking about, I can have those desires, but I can live out those desires in a faithful way. I'm not going to enter into relationships, I mean, hopefully, I mean, I may mess up because people mess up, but, I mean, in theory, what I'm trying to do is enter into, live with those desires and relate to other people in a responsible way. And that's my opportunity now, even as I desire to be married. Okay, so we're at the end. I think it's likely that I may be done with 1 Corinthians for a while. I may be back next time, who knows, but I think I'm done. So, it's been fun. Thanks for listening.